Welcome to the Max Finance Podcast, where a certified financial planner and personal finance geek discuss how to make intentional financial decisions that maximize your money and achieve your goals. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Max Finance Podcast. Last episode, we had looked into what are some of the things that you need to think about before you start investing. Prior to that, we made the case for passive investing. So be sure to check those episodes out if you haven't already. But this episode is a very interesting one. You know, there's all sorts of accounts out there. There's all sorts of jargon, you know, IRAs, 401ks, you know, different accounts here, there, otherwise. Which one's the right for you, given your situation and what you're trying to do? Anything else I missed on that framing, Lauren, that we want to cover and dive into?
I'm just excited to talk about this because I think this is something that can be very overwhelming and confusing for a lot of people. So I'm hoping we can help them figure that out.
Yeah. And so I think a great place to start really is we've got taxable accounts, and so maybe providing some definitions and some of the basics here. So once you get to a point where you've saved enough for, say, an emergency fund in your bank account or a savings account, separate account, you can then kind of venture into the world of investing. And so there is some interchangeable words. A taxable account just simply means that you are using after-tax dollars in what's called a brokerage account. And a brokerage account is almost like a savings account, except you're able to invest those dollars in, rather than just kind of park them in a bank account. So they also have money market funds that you can stow your money away. But yeah, broadly speaking, you're kind of venturing into that world where you want to invest. And so a brokerage account is a way to do that on what we call a taxable account. So you may hear us kind of refer to a brokerage account as either a taxable account, and depending on how we're framing it there. So I think that's the initial framing on the taxable side. Lauren, you want to take a shot on the tax sheltered or qualified side?
Yeah, and I think I'll definitely try to draw comparisons to the taxable, because I think you started from the taxable. I think something that is important to think about is when you sell an investment in a taxable account, I think what also makes it, what I think of it as taxable, is that you are taxed on the gain. So, you know, if you bought a stock or an index fund at, you know, at $1,000 a share, and then you sold it for $2,000 a share, you will pay tax on the difference. So the $1,000. So, so paying tax on that obviously is something that you have to do. Versus tax sheltered, I think it's pretty broad, but I think it means it has some sort of tax benefits. And so depending on the type, sometimes that might mean you get a tax deduction when you make a contribution. Sometimes it means you don't pay any taxes on those gains. Sometimes there's some very special unique things where actually you can kind of
there
are a few investments, maybe just one actually, that you can, like an HSA, where you can actually, you don't pay tax on both sides. But yeah, at a high level, that's kind of how I think about it. It's really about, are you getting a discount on taxes either before or later or not at all?
Yeah, important point. Yeah, also when you pull the dollars out on the brokerage side, it's taxable and subject to capital gains. Also, probably good to lay the basics out there. So capital gains is, so you make an investment and let's say you sell it. There's could be a capital gain or a capital loss, depending on how much you bought it for.
Right.
In the case, let's say that you've done well and you have a capital gain, there also needs to be another further refinement of capital gain, which is either a short-term capital gain or a long-term capital gain. Short-term is defined as a year or less. In other words, you have held that position, that you've held that particular investment for less than a year. And in order to qualify for long-term capital gains, then you need to hold that for more than a year. So it's 8-366. And so, you know, it's also important probably to, as we're kind of delving into some of the jargon here, the difference between a short-term capital gain from a tax perspective and a long-term capital gain. There is a benefit. So the government is incentivizing those who are holding their investments for over the long term. And the rates can be anywhere from 0 to 20%. There's some further nuance with regard to net investment income tax. We won't necessarily delve into that, but
That's for long-term capital.
Correct.
Gain.
Correct. Right. Yeah. Long-term capital gain is anywhere from 0 to 20%. And then short-term is taxed very similarly like your ordinary income. So it's taxed at the ordinary income tax rate. So that can go all the way up to 37%. Not to mention, you know, again, maybe going a little further in the rabbit hole than we want to, but each state may have, you know, their own version of that as well. But I'd say broadly speaking, most states do not have a difference between long-term capital gains and short-term capital gains. They just treat it all as income. So California is a popular example. It just treats all income as income. So that decision, and then kind of hearkening back to our passive or case for passive investing, and more about being taking a long-term lens on it, within a brokerage account, how you view your investing could have some tax implications that could save you some money if you're taking more of a long approach to it.
Sure. So you mentioned, yeah, we kind of defined what is an example or what is a taxable account. What are the types of tax sheltered accounts? What are some examples of those?
Yeah, I think that the most popular example probably would be a 401k. I think not everybody has access to one of those, but it's an employer sponsored plan and allows you to contribute money in either pre-tax or potentially post-tax. In other words, you're paying the taxes right now. And then when you pull the money out, that comes out tax-free. So that's known as a Roth 401k. The 401k is probably the biggest example. You also have IRAs, and same concept there. You can either elect to pay the taxes now, or you can not pay, contribute to a traditional IRA and not pay those taxes now. However, there's some nuance as well in the IRA space relative to the 401k.
Mm-hmm. So for someone who, let's say they have access to a 401k, I think pretty much everyone can contribute to some sort of IRA, I believe, with some nuances. And then obviously anyone can contribute to a taxable account. What are kind of some guidelines or rules of thumb or just considerations that people should think about when deciding which one to contribute to first? Yeah, I guess just let's say contribute to first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say, there's certainly a hierarchy or priority list potentially depending on your goals. So again, really it's focused on your goals, but let's say that there isn't a pressing need for the dollars, your savings, your surplus cash flow. Let's say that there's no pressing need and you just simply want to optimize. So I think one of the first places to start is to assess whether or not you have an employer match to your 401k. That's going to be the best way to, I guess, if you want to think of it that way, juice returns and get a guaranteed return. As we shared on a previous episode, definitely check in to see how long is this vesting schedule. Not all companies are very nice and give an instant vest, meaning the contributions that they make, all of your contributions instantly vest, but the contributions that they make may be subject to a vesting schedule, meaning they give you a certain amount over time. So I know when I was working at Vanguard, it was like a 5 or 6 year vesting schedule, which is surprising to me because Vanguard is really, really big investments and
that's
make sure people
time.
Are, in relation to their clients like Google, that they had the 401k for, and those are instantly invested dollars. Not only that, depends on how much they contribute. So a place like Google, they contribute 50% up to the legal limit. So half of 19,500, which is the amount that you're able to contribute to a 401k in 2021. However, not all companies do that. And, probably depends on the size and how well they're doing financially and so forth. But competition for talent, et cetera, et cetera. But, it's very common to see matching in the, you know, kind of you contribute 4% will match, you know, 3% or will match, you contribute 4% of your salary and we match 50% of every dollar that you put in. So there's all sorts of matching formulas out there. So get a sense of what that looks like for your situation. If you don't have a 401k, there's all sorts of other employer sponsored plans, particularly if you're working for governments and nonprofits and stuff like that. There's different subsections of the IRS code that are similar like accounts that operate similarly to a 401k that may have that same matching concept. Or if you're a teacher, as an example, you maybe have a pension and those dollars are automatically mandated, taken out for you. So your future self will very much like you. I know the cash flow constraint on that, it hurts. But the thing is, much like we've talked about in previous episodes, if you don't actually see the money, or you get a raise and maybe you put some of that aside, that you don't really experience that lifestyle increase. So it may not necessarily be as painful as it might otherwise would.
Yeah, absolutely. So if someone's already, if they've contributed to their 401k, kind of maximize that employer match, or their employer doesn't provide a match, then what, I guess, you know, is it a IRA or is it a brokerage? And, you know, is the IRA always better, assuming you don't need the money anytime soon? That's kind of how I think about it usually, but I'm curious to hear if there's any kind of other considerations there.
Yeah, again, let's take the scenario where there's not that many goals, but you're simply trying to optimize. Usually it's the case where you have so many goals where there's not enough resources, so you have to be very careful in the consideration. So I'll start the easier path, potentially easier path, which is to say you have fewer goals, but enough resources to contribute and try to optimize. So I still like the 401k. Now, there's some consideration to be done regarding the investment choice. So, each 401k or each employer-sponsored plan may have access to certain types of investments. Some are, not all investments are created equal. And so some are better than others. Some are more aligned with, for example, the approach that we like, that are more of a passive approach, more of a low-cost approach. I think a lot of companies are now starting to offer index funds and low-cost options. So keep your eyes out for that. Within an IRA, you have the freedom. You're not necessarily tied to the firm that the employer is taken.
And you can just open up anywhere.
Exactly. So then that gives you a lot more investment choice. For those clients that, again, don't necessarily have a bunch of goals and have a good amount of savings, it could make sense to, maybe start to divvy up a certain amount into retirement accounts, so i.e. a 401k or maybe an IRA, and then also establish some on the brokerage side, because the likelihood that you're going to need those dollars in between now and when you can pull out your retirement dollars, which is 59 and a half. So in other words, if you pulled your dollars out before 59 and a half, there would be a penalty of 10% on the amount that you're pulling out, in addition to potentially paying tax on those dollars.
This is for withdrawing from a 401k.
Yeah. Right. Well, and also an IRA as well.
Or a traditional IRA.
Traditional IRA, right?
Yeah. I think we should talk about some of the benefits of a Roth IRA, which is you can withdraw your contributions, right, at any given time. So the amount that you have contributed, you can withdraw that at any given time without any penalty or interest, right? So
would be some reasons why somebody would want to do that? Why would the flexibility of having to take your dollars out? I mean, what would be a rationale for somebody to take money out of their retirement accounts, I guess?
Well, I think, I think pulling money out of a retirement account should be sort of a last kind of choice of where to pull money from, because you usually can't replace it that year. And so, there's certain limits that you can contribute every year. And if you pull money out, that's kind of just a lost opportunity. But, I would say, for any reason that people truly need money, right? So they lose a job, some sort of emergency, maybe they get some medical bills. I think pulling money out of a retirement account is always better than taking a huge hit to your credit score, for instance, if you're not able to meet your kind of debt or obligations. Obviously, I think a large kind of short-term purchase that people will use investment funds for is, you know, making a down payment on a house or something like that, or some sort of expense that you need to get a job or to move. And so I think pulling money out of a Roth IRA is not ideal, but if that's the only money that you have available, I think it's what you have to do. And so the flexibility with a Roth IRA is, I think, really great compared to a traditional IRA or a 401k, which you would have to pay a penalty, and not, I guess, not interest, but you would pay penalty and then I guess tax on it. But a Roth IRA, you've already paid tax on it. But yeah, so anyway, that's just kind of the flexibilities I think of there. And even compared to a taxable account, I mean, I guess we should talk more about the nuance of a Roth and how the tax treatment is. But when you pull money out of a taxable account, you will have to pay taxes on those gains. So whereas a Roth IRA, you can only pull out your contributions, I guess, to begin with. So, but yeah, let's kind of dive in a little bit more, I think, into the differences. I think both on the 401k and on the IRA side, you have this choice between, quote unquote, traditional or pre-tax versus Roth. Because now, yeah, 401ks now have the ability to contribute to a Roth. And I believe that you know, this special ability to pull money out anytime, that doesn't apply to a Roth 401k. Unfortunately, that just only applies to a Roth IRA. So, but besides that, like, what is the kind of the main differences of the tax treatment between, you know, traditional versus Roth? And maybe let's start with an IRA, and then we can talk about maybe a 401k.
Yeah. So starting with IRA, one of the biggest questions is, should I contribute to a traditional IRA or should I contribute to a Roth IRA? And so I think this is really dictated by a number of factors. What is your current income? Are you in the highest tax rate that you have ever been in, or is this a down year? So, for example, if you're in sales, or maybe you took a role, maybe you were working at a public company and now you're working at a startup, and your income's a little bit less, and so your tax rate there would be a little bit less. We're trying to pinpoint where the tax rate is lowest, or at least that's the way I walk clients through which one to contribute to, and so. Very often, however, you could be, you know, hey, this is the most money I've ever made. Now, if you're early on in your career, you know, and you expect to earn, you know, a lot more in the future in 10 years than you are now, and that'll be you'll be in a much different tax bracket, then it could make sense to start with the Roth IRA. Now, importantly, and maybe some listeners are thinking, well, hey, I make too much money, or you know, it's not as easy as just putting the money in there. So do want to dive into a little bit more here, which is for 2021, in order to make what's known as a deductible IRA contribution, a deductible traditional IRA contribution, if you are filing single, you have to make $65,000 or less in order to make a full deductible contribution. What do I mean by that? Well, so you're able to contribute, you can contribute no matter how much money you can make, you can contribute to an IRA. The factor is, will you be able to take a deduction at the end of the year for the amount that you're putting in? And then we also have to make known too, how much can you put in? So, you know, you're able to put in $6,000 for 2021. I say these numbers in this particular year because they change every year and potentially grow with inflation. So sometimes they stay the same. So it's important to be mindful there.
So yeah, I want to take a quick step back and like talk about why the deduction matters. And I think that a high level, right, the difference between a traditional IRA and a Roth IRA is, you know, with a traditional IRA, assuming you qualify based on your income, you can take a tax deduction for that contribution in that year, right? So if you make if you had $50,000 of income, and you made a $5,000 contribution to a traditional IRA, you would reduce your taxable income by $5,000, right? So you'd get a tax deduction the year that you made the contribution. And then, however, though, when you go to withdraw that money, in the future, when you're 65, that's or something like that, when you can make a qualified withdrawal, you will pay tax on that withdrawal because you got a tax deduction to start. Therefore, you pay tax when you withdraw it. And I believe that tax is at your just ordinary income rate at the time when at the year that you're withdrawing it, right? Versus a Roth IRA is the opposite, right? So you don't get any sort of tax deduction when you make the contribution, but and then because you've already paid tax on these dollars, you can make those withdrawals completely tax free when you reach the qualified kind of retirement age. Right.
Exactly.
So I think that's sort of why when we talk about what we think your kind of income level will be and your tax bracket will be, that that's sort of the way that I think about it is like, what is your tax bracket now? And how do you think that will compare to your potential tax bracket when you are actually making these withdrawals when you're sort of 65 and older, right? Because if you're in a very high tax bracket now and you're able to make contributions that you can deduct for taxes, it seems like a good idea to kind of get the most bang for your buck, save the most in taxes now, and then later when you withdraw, you'll pay taxes, but you'll be in a lower tax bracket so that it's smaller. But if you're very early in your career, you're making very little money, and you actually anticipate, you know, having more income when you're at your retirement age, then a Roth might make more sense for you.
Yeah. And so it's important to assess, you know, as best as you can, hey, am I going to be in a higher tax bracket in my peak earning years? Am I relative to what I was earning in previous years? Am I in a higher tax bracket or am I just starting out? And I anticipate there being some high taxes that you'll be paying in your peak earning years. And then, of course, assessing, like you said, in retirement, you know, when do you plan to retire? So as an example, at age 72, as of this date of this recording, that is when required minimum, so adding more jargon alert, more required minimum distributions start, which means the government, if you have contributed dollars into a pre-tax account, retirement account, the government wants their money. They've allowed you to defer, to kick the can, the tax can down the road. And so they say, hey, this particular age, which right now is 72, we want you to start distributing some of those dollars, and we want some of that income, the tax income that we've been missing all these years. And so there's a chart, a table that tells us how much money you're required to distribute every year. So again, most listeners probably are not 72 or older, so maybe not something that they're thinking about, you know, in the front of their mind, but it's important to think about because this helps us in the understanding of when does it make sense to contribute to a pre-tax versus a Roth account, a post-tax. Because I'll give you the scenario. So let's say that you wanted to retire at age 65. So you've got 7 years before, again, at least as of right now, who knows what they'll do in the future, before they require you to pull money out. So what's so important about that? Well, there's also an ability. Let's say you started to accumulate all those dollars and you didn't pay any attention to Roth whatsoever. There is an ability at age 65 to start to convert. So in other words, willingly pay the taxes at that particular time and move dollars from a pre-tax account. And you just, you know, say, let's say you move over $10,000. So basically all it means is you're moving it from a traditional to a Roth and you're paying the taxes associated with that $10,000 conversion. And so you can convert, as an example, all of those years up to that age 72. And so that allows you, even though all of the while they've been growing tax-free, you can figure out which time you want to use. You as an investor, as a taxpayer, you're able to kind of control your destiny in terms of when you want to pay the taxes there rather than waiting. So if you continue to work, let's say you worked all the way up until this age 72 or beyond, even if you're continuing to work, there's still required minimum distribution, and meaning that you're going to have to pull those dollars out. So it's you know, again, if you're like in your 20s or 30s, it just may seem so far away that many years out. But, you know, it's worth kind of thinking about, do I see myself working until age 72? Am I on track to maybe retire before then. If I wanted to retire at say 65, you know, am I honestly going to be retiring, or am I, you know, probably going to keep myself busy? I can see myself always doing something, and maybe I'm continually earning income. You know, the skill set that you've developed over the years, are you going to continue to be, you know, maybe doing freelance stuff? And I think there were some studies out, but that showed, you know, those that thought they were going to be in a lower tax bracket, it turns out that they weren't actually. So I think it's worth an honest assessment to see, you know, are you going to continue to be working, potentially earning income, even at a higher rate? But again, it's really trying to compare the tax brackets now versus, you know, tomorrow. The other layer of complexity, some people may say, well, hey, you know, based on this administration or that administration, I feel like taxes are going to be increased in the future. And so they are big proponents of let's always pay the tax now, because regardless of what my income will be, I think taxes will be higher. So there's, you know, as we kind of peel back the layers of the onion, there's a lot of different things to think about there. But I definitely want to kind of return back to more simplified. And you know, that's just one scenario of how I talk with clients and think about, okay, does it make sense to contribute to a Roth or a traditional IRA?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly lots of considerations. Many, many considerations. I think, trying to guess what tax rates will be, or I guess, well, it's one thing to try to guess and estimate your, I wouldn't say your tax rate, but your kind of relation to your current tax rate or your position in all the tax brackets. I feel like that is a little bit more reasonable, you know, because that's something you can actually somewhat control, or not control, but you can have influence over, versus, you know, what the government is going to do 30 years from now. That seems pretty hard to
guess.
Yeah, I don't think really anyone has a crystal ball that can be able to do that. So yeah, I think at a high level, we talked about just thinking about your tax rate right now and what it will be when you actually make those withdrawals, and then trying to kind of go with that. Obviously, things like something like a Roth IRA has some special abilities to be able to draw funds, so that is definitely a strong consideration. I think we mentioned the income kind of eligibility, or the kind of max amount of income that you can earn mm-hmm. to be eligible to make a traditional IRA contribution. Does that exist? Or I think, no, that does exist for Roth contributions. Is it pretty similar in terms of that income limit? I don't know. Maybe we can just give readers an idea of what that is. And I'm sure that's a number that changes every year as well. But mm-hmm. I think it's important to understand, is because, you know, making a contribution to like a Roth IRA when you're not eligible could come with some penalties if you don't correct it or something, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So I'll just run down. I think I shared the single. So there is a limit that if you earn more than this, then you are not able to take a deduction on the traditional. So staying in the traditional IRA side, filing single, that's $65,000 or less. If you make between $65,000 and $75,000, you're able to take a partial deduction. This is known as the phase out range. And then above $75,000, you're not able to take a deduction. However, you still are, as we shared, able to make a contribution, which is important for those who are over on the Roth side. We'll share that in a bit. Married filing jointly, it's $104,000 or less. You're able to take a full deduction. If you're between $104,000 and $124,000, there's a partial deduction, and $124,000 or more, you're not able to take a deduction whatsoever. On the Roth side, so if you are single and you make $125,000 or less, so it's a much higher threshold than traditional IRA, you're able to make a full contribution. Recall that we're paying the taxes now, so it's not like you're getting any deduction. So if you make between $125,000 and $140,000, there's a partial deduction. Again, that's that phase out range on the Roth side.
There's no deduction. It's just a smaller amount of contribution that you can make, right?
Right. Sorry. Yeah. What amount can you contribute? Right. It's a partial contribution. Thanks for correcting me. Uh-huh. If you're making $140,000 or more, and this is a measurement called modified adjusted gross income, but I think just for the average listener, let's just assume you know, what you're making. You know, add up all of your sources of income, just add that number up, and I think it can be a rough ballpark for you. If you're married filing jointly and you make $198,000 or less, so again, this is these can be some sizable sums, you can make a full contribution, 198 to 208. That's a partial contribution, and then 208,000 or more, no contribution is allowed. That being said, there is an ability to make a contribution even if you're over these limits on the Roth side, and in fact, the traditional IRA side.
Sure, yeah.
You want to share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, we should, but I do want to kind of highlight that is one of the benefits of 401ks, right? Is that if your employer offers a 401k, you can make a contribution either a pre-tax, you know, which is the same as a traditional in terms of, you know, those contributions reduce your taxable income, or a Roth 401k contribution. And there are obviously limits to how much you can contribute, which is, I believe, this year's about $19,500. Mm-hmm. But there's no income limits. Like, there's no special conditions or things that you need to meet to be able to make those contributions. You don't need to worry about kind of making a contribution when you're not supposed to and getting a penalty. So I think that is one of the nice things about 401ks. And unfortunately, not everyone has access to a 401k because it is employer sponsor. But mm-hmm. I do think that just for that reason alone, I mean, you know, if mm-hmm. I think for people who, you know, when they hear us talk about income limits and contribution or income limits, and like, if they start kind of like thinking, wow, this is too overwhelming, well, you know, maybe just make a contribution to your 401k, or, you know, I think that's certainly better than nothing, and you can't really go wrong with it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, you know, in terms of that's why, you know, we talk about these income limits on the IRA side. I think the best place to start is really a 401k if you have access to it, especially if they're giving you a match. I mean, consider contributing up to the maximum level of the match. And, you know, they often give you, they put you in, you know, if you don't know which investment to choose, there's usually a default investment that's usually around a target date fund, so that you're invested and, you know, it's a process. And I think the most important thing is just to start. You don't have to be an expert out the gate in order to make these contributions. This is a process. It can, you know, you'll learn more over time. You know, you'll refine what exactly retirement could look like and all of these other fun things that, you know, we're talking about. But yeah, I think the easiest spot to start without having to worry about income limits is the 401k for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess now we can talk about kind of how to manage or maybe kind of get around some of these eligibility limits and rules, which I think is, you know, very helpful, not just for people who exceed those limits, but maybe for people who don't have a consistent income, right? Maybe they are, like you said, maybe they work in kind of in sales. And so, or maybe they're I don't know if self-employed account, but maybe they work in a manner where, you know, they're not getting paid like a fixed salary and stuff like that. So it's really hard to know what your income is going to be at the end of the year. So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think you'd be a better person to talk about this, but yeah, talk us through kind of, you know, I guess what comes to mind is what you call a backdoor Roth contribution, mm-hmm. which is, I think, the ability to contribute essentially to a Roth, even though you exceed the kind of those income eligibility limits. But yeah, can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, yeah. And so kind of referring back to the hierarchy, kind of priority items of what I would recommend kind of starting out with is paying down your debt, your high interest debt. We talked about good debt versus bad debt. You know, make sure you've got an emergency fund. Consider contributing to your 401k up to that match at least. And then, you know, there might be a step below that, which is consider maxing out your 401k potentially. Before you start to delve into this realm, because there can be some complexity. But yeah, looking at the complexity there, so it's called a backdoor IRA, a Roth IRA contribution. And so why do they call it backdoor? Well, we just referred to a number of different income limits. And so you may be in a position, a fortunate position, to make more than these income limits where you're not able to contribute directly to a Roth. So just to recap, so you know the traditional IRA numbers that we went through, those were much lower than the Roth. So if you're making over the Roth numbers, then you're not going to be able to make a deductible contribution to a traditional IRA. So however, you can still make a contribution to an IRA. It just won't be deductible. So the first step, there's a multi-part step, but what we're trying to do is we're trying to get money into the Roth. And so because you can't contribute directly because you make too much money, what you do is you first contribute into an IRA. And then the next step is that you convert those dollars into a Roth. So you do a Roth conversion in the same year, or you can potentially do in the future year. There's no income limitation to how much, you know, you could be making millions and millions of dollars, but you can still do a conversion. So it's important to recognize that that conversion, there's no oops button. Back in the day, there used to be a way for you to, oh, whoops, I over-converted too much, or
you can undo it.
You can undo it, exactly. Now there's not that ability, so you have to be very careful that we measure twice, cut once in this particular strategy.
And that's important because that conversion is taxable, right? So like the gains that, like, let's say you convert $10,000, right? And I mean, this is probably out of my depth, but some percentage of that conversion may be kind of considered taxable. Like if the basis for that conversion was $8,000 and you had $2,000 in gains, you would owe tax on that $2,000 that of the $10,000 that you convert. So so that's something to think about. But I mean, if the if you are making the contribution and doing the conversion very soon after, the amount of gains there is going to be pretty small, if not basically zero, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so the other thing I like to check for is, do we have any dollars that pre-tax dollars in IRAs? So as an example, right, sometimes people would be converting or rolling over. Let's say they have an old employer plan. They rolled it over into an IRA, a rollover IRA, which, you know, just allows you more investment choice and allows you to manage it on your own. But the challenge there is, if we have dollars, to your point, if we have dollars that are in that are pre-tax and we're over the income limits and we make a contribution into the traditional IRA, say you try to max out $6,000, you know, and you try to convert that $6,000 over to a Roth IRA, then there's what's known as the IRA account aggregation rule, which says that, okay, well, if you had, you know, let's say you had $10,000, this is where we may lose some listeners here, but bear with me. We'll get back out the other side here. So if you had made a $6,000 contribution, you had $10,000 as a rollover, what we have to do is we have to do $6,000 divided by the $16,000, which is the total amount of IRA dollars that you have in there. That ratio then would get applied to, that's how much money would be taxable versus not taxable. So the conversion. So it's a TLDR. It's a real mess if you've got IRA dollars from an old employer plan, or you've been converting, or you were under those income thresholds.
Right.
I would highly recommend that if you had any dollars, first off, if you were making contributions to a traditional IRA, maybe there's other ways to go about it rather than this particular strategy. If, however, these are rollover dollars, consider rolling over these dollars into your 401, your current employer plan, if you have access to one. Again, do not pass go if you don't have a 401k and you can't move those dollars in. It's an absolute nightmare to keep track, because basically what you have to do every single year thereafter is we have to keep track of how many dollars are pre-tax and post-tax. You can have post-tax dollars in your traditional IRA, which is, this is just the confusing part. So
I've never heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or after-tax dollars contributed in there because you didn't have a deduction. So
you didn't convert it. I see.
Exactly. Yeah. This is kind of like no man's land that you don't want to be in. So there's some things you want to make sure, just as you're doing anything, any other project, you want to make sure you're prepared, you've got the right tools, you understand the landscape, what you're getting yourself into before you go down this road. So that's why I say 401k and employer sponsored plans, there's a lot. I mean, contributing up to $19,500. Yeah. I mean, that's a really big amount of, that's a lot of money. So that's probably the first place to start. But yeah, we can start to talk about some more advanced concepts like the backdoor Roth. I mean, some people may have heard of that term. The other thing I'll say on the backdoor Roth contribution is, well, that seems a little sketchy, right? Because you're going around the stated kind of income limits. Why did they have stated income limits in the first place? You know, I'll say this. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that was the one that was passed in 2017. And in there, so I'll say this too, the IRS simply enforces its understanding of the code. The IRS code is not developed by the IRS. It's developed by Congress. That's the branch of government that passes laws and makes things into laws. And so I know we have got a lot of, angst and pointing a lot of fingers at the IRS, you know, for being the boogeyman, but really it's Congress who are enacting these laws. So
interesting.
Yeah. And so the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, there was some, so we have to look at different things. You know, there are ways to see what was Congress's intent when they wrote this law and passed this law. And so, again, the IRS is just simply interpreting what it is that they see. So the reason I'm going on this whole thing about the Roth is that Congress acknowledged this strategy, the backdoor Roth contribution. They acknowledged it, but they didn't pass it into law. And so there are other things that we can go and look at. And in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act bill, there are some notes that say of this specific scenario. And so the reason that's all important and why I'm wasting time talking about it is because that is something that the that Congress intended as a strategy. So before, you'll probably read, if you Google backdoor Roth contributions, there's probably a lot of articles that say, oh, you've got to leave some time because if the IRS catches you doing this, they will make you unwind the transaction and they will penalize you in some way. And so since that 2017 bill, there has been sort of an acknowledgement of the strategy. And then not to mention separately an IRS, so that IRS actually goes in podcasts, apparently. And so one of the commissioner or one of the top deputies there had been asked on a podcast, you know, hey, is the IRS going to pursue those folks and slap them on the wrist if they go through with this strategy? And they said no, but they didn't say, in other words, they're not going to pursue or penalize folks that are pursuing the strategy. But that being said, they're not going to be issuing guidance to say, this is how you do it. This is how you circumvent, you know, because obviously, they, you know, more revenue if you're not trying to circumvent this. But at the end of the day, you're still paying taxes on this money. You're just avoiding the tax growth. I mean, the benefit of the Roth, of course, is the growth of those dollars. So anyways, a long-winded way of saying that this strategy has been effectively blessed by Congress and IRS has said that they're not pursuing. So that distance that you once had to put, okay, maybe you put it 6 or 8 months down the road before you do the conversion, I advise my clients we don't have to do that anymore. So interesting little tidbit of how the system works, I suppose.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I'm sure all these complexities and the amount of work that it takes, even though that's been quote unquote blessed, it still, you know, keeps a lot of people away. And so maybe that still accomplishes sort of their high level goal. All right. So we've talked about kind of, you know, the differences between Roth and traditional, I think both on terms of the IRA and the 401k side. And I think, yeah, you talked about just the benefits of a 401k, which is simply you don't have to worry about these income limits, which is really nice. Are there any other considerations that we can think of? We talked about some of the different, you mentioned, I think you touched on how, you know, 401ks, you kind of have a limited fund selection depending on what your employer and, 401k provider offers, so that could be a slight benefit to an IRA where you really have a lot more kind of power as the consumer and usually get better choices and lower fees. Are there any other kind of considerations that you think that you can think of?
Well, I often get the question, you know, I've got all these old 401ks, what should I do with them? I do with them? And so, you know, you have an option to keep it there. Likely, since you've no longer worked there, you're going to be paying the fee that the employer was covering for you. So maybe some number, and depending on how many dollars are in there, that could be a high percentage as a relation to the total dollar amount versus, maybe just a very negligible amount. Maybe depending on the investment choice you have in your new employer plan, if you have access to a new employer plan, new 401k, you know, those may be better or worse. And so if those are better, then it could make sense to just consolidate, make things a little easier, just roll over your old 401k into your new 401k.
Yep.
And then, or if you don't have good choice, investment choice, you don't plan to pursue the backdoor Roth conversion there, then you know, you could consider rolling that over to an IRA where you have unlimited choice and you have access to whatever you it is that you would want to invest in. I'm curious, you know, given the open platform choice of rolling it over to an IRA, what factors do you consider when, and this certainly could be its own episode, but like, how do you evaluate which financial institution to go with?
Yeah. Well, I think just before we discuss that, I think we should just call out that we touched on it earlier, but yeah, rolling it over into an IRA, assuming it's you had pre-tax 401k dollars and now you're rolling it over into a, I guess, a just an IRA, a non-Roth IRA, is that you know, if you wanted to do a backdoor Roth in the future, you would get kind of caught up in that pro rata rule. So something to think about if you intend to do that in the future, rolling it over to a 401k might be better. But in terms of like what kind of the features of a brokerage, you know, I think that's a good question. I think, you know, I think obviously fund selection is really important, right? We talked about passive investing in past episodes, and I think so having access to a low cost index funds is really important. You know, I guess some custodians might charge you fees on top of that, but I feel like that's pretty rare right now. So you know, look out for that. I would say, like, consider any kind of fees that the custodian themselves charge you. But I think in most cases, there very often aren't any, for at least major ones. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's definitely something we can talk about in future, you know, at podcast episodes. You know, unfortunately, sometimes, you know, obviously with a 401k provider, you don't get a choice, right? So you're kind of stuck with whatever 401k that your current provider, your current employer uses. And so, you know, there for some people, having that simplicity of having fewer relationships with different financial institutions, there's just benefit there in terms of, you know, being able to get kind of simplified account statements or log into one or, you know, fewer websites to check your balances and stuff like that. But yeah, I would say besides fund selection and fees, there's not too many other, I would say, but, you know, I've just kind of always stuck with the big ones. I'd say, like, you know, Vanguard and Fidelity are the two that I always look at, but I've heard good things about Schwab as well. But yeah, I think that's something we might talk about in future episodes, but curious to hear your initial thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's all sorts. I mean, there's so many different firms out there that you may inherit from your old employers. You just maybe you rolled it over just out of convenience into an IRA that's at that same firm. There's all sorts of smaller firms out there as well that you know, they don't necessarily have the same level of technology and dollars that they can invest in their technology. And I know that a lot of people I've heard complaints, even with the big ones, that like, hey, this is not a fun experience. This is not a modern experience. You know, there's the user experience of navigating what to do, where, and how to do things, especially as they're kind of pushing you all to do things self-serve and online, can be quite frustrating. But in relation, broadly speaking, even though the financial industry isn't necessarily the quickest to adopt the newest tech, say for a small subsector in the fintech space. Yeah, I think the bigger ones, there's just sort of been a race to zero in terms of cost. And so they realized that, you know, hey, back in the day, like they would charge you a fee to transact into one mutual fund to another, or now they have like a collection of, it seems like an ever increasing collection of funds that you can transact into and out of for free and not have to pay a commission or a transaction fee there. So, you know, broadly speaking, I think the big three do that, where they're fairly similar, and they're competing so heavily that if one were to really game change something, and it's not to say they haven't, but you know, anytime there is something that has been a material move, the others adopt it. I mean, it's just they did recognize that people are just going to flock to the better functionality or tool or whatever it may be. So I'd say that they're all fairly similar. When I say all, I'd say Schwab, Vanguard, Fidelity. I'd say Schwab and Fidelity are more known for their opportunity to invest in other things. Vanguard is a little bit more parental, and they want to make sure that you're investing in their funds. That's, to me, that's not that bad of a thing, because I like Vanguard funds. I think they're very low cost. I like what they do with their investment. So yeah, as we say, we could probably spend a whole episode diving into the different platforms there. But yeah, certainly consider as you're evaluating what to do with old employer funds.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to think, is there anything else to cover in terms of choosing accounts?
So it's two things that I want to bring up, and the first is, so don't underestimate the power of the brokerage account. So even though we focused a lot of the episode on tax savings and a way to avoid or willingly pay the tax now and save taxes later, retirement is not the only goal in town. So there's a lot of other goals that people are really trying to focus on. And so the brokerage account, and we didn't talk about college funding. I know that 529 and the options there can be some nuance on that. That could be probably its own episode. HSA as well, that's super powerful. As you mentioned, I want to emphasize that even more. So the triple tax benefit, the ability to contribute dollars pre-tax, they grow tax-free, pull them out tax-free for qualified expenses, and that's quite broad in its approach. And then not to mention the more advanced strategy in that, which is you can save your receipts and you could pay them out of pocket, let's say in 1 year, but you can take the dollars out in a years down the line, and that could be an interesting strategy to pursue while those dollars are growing. But yeah, don't underestimate the brokerage account. So going back to that simplistic scenario where maybe I don't have that many goals, you put some dollars aside and up to maybe that match there for the 401k, but maybe you set up two brokerage accounts. You can set up as many as you want, just like a checking or savings account. You can have hundreds if you want, which is crazy. I don't know why you would, but if you set up two, maybe you have one that's allocated more conservatively and then another that's allocated more aggressively. So why would you do that? Well, it stands to reason, as we talked about in previous episodes, that if you have a goal that occurs in the next couple of years, you would probably not want that to be as aggressively allocated as one that occurs in 10 plus years. So there may be some amount, even if you don't have goal well-defined, maybe you say, okay, I'm going to put a certain amount of money in the retirement account, and then the surplus dollars outside of my emergency fund, I'm just going to start contributing. Maybe it's half and half. Maybe it's 25% in the long term, because you've got some other dollars that are also allocated long term, and you've got 75% of the dollars that you are saving into a short term brokerage. So there's all sorts of interesting ways we can structure things where it's okay to not be the most tax advantageous. The benefit there is you have the flexibility to pull those dollars out without any worry, other than, of course, the tax, capital gains tax. So it's just something to give yourself the flexibility. Oftentimes, sometimes I see folks just, contributing far too much in, dare I say, into the retirement accounts and neglecting, like, oh my gosh, I'm retirement rich, but I don't have any way to pay for, hey, I want to buy a home. And that's what I was looking to do for the last however many years. It's hard to find those dollars without paying a penalty to get access to them. So, it's sort of this balance of, saving for tomorrow, saving for, a shorter tomorrow and a longer tomorrow.
Yeah, I think we've, kind of been speaking a little bit more with kind of retirement in mind, but I think it's just really important and to evaluate what your goals are and sort of timelines and cash needs in the next 5, 10, 15 years, and just make sure that the money that you do invest, you have access it. You have access to it when you need it. So, definitely think about that and make sure you invest accordingly.
Any closing or final thoughts that you have about the episode today?
I think I would say this decision can be hard, or it can feel very daunting. And I think you mentioned earlier, like, I think it is, try not to let it stop you from just getting started. Like I said, like, so anyone can open up a brokerage account. So if you feel too overwhelmed, and you're not sure about your income limits, or, anyone can open up a brokerage account. And those are maybe some of the easiest to open up, because I think there's a lot of companies now that make it really easy to open up a brokerage account right on your phone, right? Like, I don't want to call out a sub, but there's just many, many things that are available and they're very easy to open up. And if that's how you kind of get started, I think that's totally fine. You know, maybe after a year or two, then maybe consider some of the other options available. But I think just investing is better than not investing and keeping it in like a checking or savings account, which is probably not even beating inflation. So yeah, just get started. I think there's always more to learn in any aspect of taxes and personal finance. You'll never figure it out first. So don't try to figure everything out before you start.
Yeah, you can very easily get into analysis paralysis as you try to like weigh all of the different things we've shared. But yeah, very curious to hear your thoughts. Did we get to, I mean, this is a very jargon heavy episode, I'd say, and you know, probably getting into a lot of the meat and potatoes of what you want to hear. But very curious if there were any sections where you want us to go into more detail, or you want us to clarify, or you know, maybe there's a strategy that you thought was very good that we didn't touch on. Would love to hear that. Feel free to drop us a line at feedback@maxfinancepodcast.com. Again, that's feedback@maxfinancepodcast.com. That'll go directly to us, and we'll incorporate your feedback and curious any questions as well about your different options. So yeah, don't hesitate to let us know. And yeah, thanks everybody for listening in, and hopefully that was helpful, and hope you all have a great rest of your day.
See you later.
We're a new podcast, and it would mean the world to us if you took a moment to write a review in the Apple Podcasts app or share this episode with a friend or family member. We'd like to hear from you. Is there a topic you're interested in? Have feedback more generally? Email us at feedback@maxfinancepodcast.com. Thanks, and see you next time.